This is Disabled Girls Who Lift. We are reclaiming what's rightfully ours one podcast at a time. It's Mary Beth, Chloe, and Marcia bringing you the thoughts and unpopular topics to get you out of that ableist comfort zone. Welcome, everyone, to yet another episode of Disabled Girls Who Lift. This is Marcia, and I'm coming in from South Florida, aka land of the Seminole Tribe.
And this is Mary Beth from California, aka land of Ohlone Tribe. Our guest joining us today, I am so excited for Ryan Kress to come and talk some shit about what's going on in the medical field, in the modeling and entertainment field, in EDS and sport, in her hometown, Roanoke, Virginia. Such a pleasure to finally get to talk to you and to have you on board, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Happy to have you. I know we've been chasing and going back and forth, but life happens.
Amen to that.
Us disabled folks know the most. Life happens.
That's for sure.
Yeah. So I'm curious because on your page, you point out, you know, you're very active in modeling, entertainment, you're a nurse, all that good stuff. But you also point out in a lot of times that you weren't always a full-time chair user. So I'm wondering what and when and how and what happened and how did that transition go? Was it one day you woke up like, ah, fuck? Or was it like a slow change and you finally accepted it? Like, how did that go?
So, for me and for listeners that don't know me, I was born with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which, you know, it's a connective tissue disorder, it's a collagen deficiency that causes all of my collagen to be super stretchy and all my joints to dislocate really easily and a plethora of other issues. But the most that actually relate to me in using a chair is just the fact that my hips, knees, and ankles all dislocate way too easily, mostly from repeated dislocations because I was a dancer growing up. And so I did a lot of damage to my hips and even feet and all of that just normally. But because I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, it was dislocating every time I would come to dance class multiple times and wearing away at that joint. So what started as a cool party trick of me being able to pop out specifically my left hip on command over the years, kind of, they just don't stay in at all now. When I stand, my left hip, it just kind of falls out, which sounds just as gross as it is. But it started out, I guess, about 5-ish years ago. But now, started with the limp, and then I went on to using a cane for a little while, but the cane was putting way too much pressure on my wrists and elbows and just kind of putting too much on my arms, so I went to forearm crutches with my physical therapist, and I was doing that about 2 years ago. I was working as a full-time ER nurse, just getting by when I was at work and using mobility aids outside of work. And I was getting fitted for my forearm crutches and kind of learning to use those. And my physical therapists were just like, yeah, I think that we're actually at the point of needing a chair. And so at first I was kind of using them simultaneously, using my crutches at work and using my chair to, you know, do things like grocery shop or any time where I would be doing being on my feet for an extended period of time. Now it has slowly gotten to the point where I am using the chair all the time. I can get around short distances. I can stand. I just have a super severe limp and I walk like a pregnant duck. But other than that, just mainly my chair. And it was expected, but not. I was told when I was diagnosed at 16, I'm 28 now, that I'd be in a chair by the time I was 20. And I made it to 26, so I'll take that. And it was I don't want to say surprisingly difficult adjustment, because it seems very obvious that adjusting to a wheelchair would be difficult. But for me, it wore on me more than I expected. the actual mental health issues were worse than the actual physical getting used to being a chair user, getting used to living in a world that's, you know, not accessible and not made for us. So the actual mental blows that I took, my marriage suffered. I was trying to relate to people, anyone around me, the people who lived with me, I didn't feel like were supporting me or were very helpful in my transition or dealing with those mental health issues. I started having panic attacks. I was just stressed to the max. I had to leave my job of bedside nursing. I had to move and find a new place to live because there were 16 steps to my front door of my old house, and my bedroom was on the second floor.
So, no, that wasn't going to work.
No. So I lost my job, my dream job, my house, and ended up my family, my marriage. I was in a polyamorous quad, and the strain that it kind of took on that, and then choices that I made during that with my mental health and everything led to losing my family as well. So it was just like one thing after another. And I had to process all that on top of being a new wheelchair user. So it was like a hell of a transition for me, for sure. One that you definitely never really stop adjusting, and you never really stop with that mental battle. But one that I definitely would say that my life is 20 times better than it ever was before I was using the chair, just because I do have the energy. I can work full time again. Things are looking up, that's for sure.
So do you feel like you've arrived, or are you still working towards something?
I think I have both arrived as far as kind of now knowing who I am as a person and just how strong I really can be because of what I was put through, and what I kind of was able to overcome. But it's an everyday battle. You know, there'll be someone will look me wrong or ask me the wrong thing in the elevator at work, or, you know, doubt the fact that I'm their nurse for the millionth time that day. And some days it hits harder than it does.
Oh, I can't even imagine how being an ER nurse is, and they're like, I'm sorry, you're in the wrong room.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Constantly.
But definitely realizing a lot about yourself and how strong you are independently, too, after leaving some of those relationships. So how was that, like, taking a step away from all of those people who, you know, were with you almost every step of the way?
It was a crash course in learning who I was and what I was capable of, because you're right, I had these people around me constantly, not only as partners, but caregivers. They knew, you know, my medications. They knew, oh, you know, she looked like she was going to pass out because her blood pressure's dropped. They knew what to do for that. And so it was a lot of, okay, not only do I need to learn how to exist on my own as a single woman, this was also the first time that I was going to be single as a, you know, pretty heavily disabled woman. So there was that kind of adjustment at the same time, as well as having to find a new career within nursing, because I couldn't work at the bedside anymore at that time. And I'm, as hard as it was when I went through it all, or when it was really the heat of going through it all, I'm so grateful for everything, because if you'd asked me this time last year if I thought I was able to live in a studio apartment by myself, you know, do all this stuff alone by myself, I would have laughed in your face. But here I am doing it, so.
We are the strongest people in the world, y'all. We are. And hey, I got to give you props. I think you're our first poly guest.
Really?
In all these years. And it's only been a few years. A few months. I'm sorry.
Feels like years. Feels like a lifetime.
I want to delve so much deeper into that too, because, like, personally, that's a lot of how I found myself, found my sexuality, found how you truly can be independent from other lovers, other spiritual partners, sexual partners, intimate ones, physical ones, you know, by having more in a quad or a poly relationship. And stepping away from that, I'm sure, was both necessary and like relieving to you. And in a pandemic, you know, how much did that affect like your daily?
It was bizarre because I was used to living in this house with three other people at all times.
Oh, y'all live together.
We all live together. Oh, yeah. And we all, you know, work different shifts. So there was always mm-hmm. somebody home. You know, that was a good thing and a bad thing because you never had any time by yourself ever. But there was always someone around. So if, you know, if I took a fall because there were so many steps in our home, that happened a lot. Or if, you know, my blood pressure dropped or there was something medical going on with me, there was always someone there to help me out. And so moving into this new apartment, I've had to think about things like I had to get, you know, a Google Home because, you know, it's a little classier than Life Alert and it is 2020, but I needed some way, you know, to call for help if I fell and couldn't get back up. You know, I had to think about things like how I was going. There wasn't always like a 6'5" tall man around to get stuff off the top shelf. I had to figure out, you know, how I'm going to do that. So not only was it getting up the courage to kind of branch out and be by myself and live on my own, it was also, hey, I have to do this with a disability. That is also fairly new as far as mobility limitations anyway. It was definitely a lot. I am glad for it. Obviously, like, our situation had become very toxic on all sides when we all kind of left. You know, there are days where, you know, I miss that village feeling. And that's why, you know, I do identify so strongly with polyamory. Because growing up in the South, or my family, not everyone was actually blood related to me. And I always had adults everywhere and people everywhere all the time. And so getting to this point in my life where I'm alone more than I'm not is so strange, but also kind of nice for now while it's new.
Yeah, forced but welcome change. I feel like there's definitely a lot of people that you can tell whether this pandemic forcing them to isolate or stay at home or the shelter in place, wherever, you know, depending on where you're at, you can really tell who has trouble just sitting with themselves.
Yeah.
Because these are the people that are saying they're so bored, they're so restless, they're this, they're that. These are the people that are like, you know, jogging out of nowhere, even though they've hated running their whole lives. But we have to be able to do that. If you can't just hang out with yourself, then you can't hang out with anyone else either.
And even if there's not someone physical there, like, I think this is one of the most social times, Zooming and Skyping every week way more often than people ever did, or talking on the phone way more often than people did, and finding connections with other, you know, other friends who you didn't realize had all these similarities. Which is why this online like community of Instagram or Facebook or whatever has been wild. Mm-hmm. The entire world sat down and watched, you know, George Floyd get killed by police. And like, we're all experiencing all of these things together: divorce, depression, anxiety, homelessness, like poverty, everything. We're all experiencing it together. And I guess finding other relationships that are somewhat more meaningful than the ones you had before.
I think it was so strange for me because working in healthcare, so I never got to shelter in place, or, you know, I didn't really get to quarantine or do anything like that at all. I've been continually working the entire time. And, you know, we didn't really get that choice. And so it's weird for me because, I still kind of have to remind myself, like, okay, this is not normal for everyone else. Everyone else's life, like everyone in my family that I was living with at the time was also still working. So it was very odd coming from that point of view, and also very hard not to get bitter because we were the only ones who were still working and were having to work harder than we've been working before, way harder, way longer hours as a nurse, not a lot of direction. Nobody really knew what COVID was and what it is and what it can do to you and what the detrimental effects will be from being exposed early on and all that stuff. And so it was very hard not to look at your friends who were, you know, getting to work from home for the first time, and they're really excited about that, and you're over here working your butt off.
Yeah. Not only is it draining, you're putting your life on the line every single day. And as a woman with a disability, Jesus Christ, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a new form of triggering just to see the people that are like protesting because they want to go to the bar and fucking Chili's. Like,
oh my God. I need a haircut.
Like, masks or cages. Like, are you for real right now? Do you know my life?
Right? Like, seriously? You're that concerned about it? Just put the freaking mask on your face and go to the grocery store. You're gonna be fine.
Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
2 seconds.
Yeah, so that's definitely been one way in which social media has not been good for me, and seeing people that are just like living life like nothing happened, having parties, having weddings. Especially in Florida, which is still like coronavirus popping, like having competitions, having meets, like what's happening? it's not fun. So I'm guessing since you're working 10,000 hours and you're moving and getting settled, what is your movement looking like? Are you still doing anything in a free time? Do you have a free time? What is a free time look
what
like?
What is free time? Yeah. Very little free time. But the bit that I've had, I've gotten to, you know, the beautiful thing about living alone is I get to prioritize my free time and do what I want to do with it. So mine has been a lot of learning to work out from home, because the gym became very important to me with my disability. Probably about 5 years ago or so. Prior to that, I said I was a dancer. I was in the marching band in high school. Like, I was not traditionally athletic in any way, shape, or form. I hated running more than anything in the world, and now we know it's because my hips popped out of socket. But I thought that I was just kind of like a lazy kid. I was terrified of the gym. I remember I worked as an EMT at the gym in college, and I was just like, I don't know. I don't know how to do all this. It's very complicated. And the people at my undergrad were very judgmental, and I was just like, you know, I'm not doing this. And then my ex-husband and I joined like a local Y about 5 years ago, and he's like, all right, come on, you're going to come with me. Oh, I don't want to do this. Those machines are complicated. He's like, just come on, just try it. Like, all right. And it took about a week and a half, and I finally started figuring out what the hell I was doing. And suddenly I was hooked, mainly because suddenly I was moving better. I had more energy to be able to put up with the constant dislocations, and I could keep my blood pressure up for longer, and, you know, I could be upright longer. Instead of constantly having to lie down or take a nap or take a rest. So working out and lifting for me has become if I don't lift, I don't get around. I can't do my job. I can't function for as long as I need to keep up with my online platform, to have this go, go, go schedule that I do. There's no way. And so it was insanely important to me, and also very scary when the pandemic first hit and all the gyms closed. I was like, I am not prepared to work out at home. I'm not prepared to do any of this. I don't have the stuff that I need, and there's no way to buy it. But this has been a cool kind of learning curve to get better at working out from home and using what I have, especially moving and learning what I have access to in my new town and what I can do in my new space, which is a lot more than my old one, so I'm cool with that. But yeah, lots of lifting from home, and just got back into the gym probably about 3 weeks ago, because it's my gym specifically is just other healthcare workers. So we just all file over right from the hospital.
Were you doing that all on your own in the beginning, or did you have help? Or were you just like Googling like crazy, or like, did you fail? Was it terrible? How did it start?
It started with a lot of Pinterest and a lot of YouTube and a lot of my ex kind of teaching me just the basics. I was always afraid of free weights because of my dislocation. He taught me a bit with free weights, and it was constantly like, no, I can't do that. No, there's no way I could do that. I didn't have the base muscle built up around my joints at all. I mean, my legs are pretty good from dance, but my upper body had little to nothing. But because of my EDS, I've been in physical therapy since I was 12 for almost every joint. So a lot of these movements, I'm like, oh, okay. It's the thing that I've been doing in therapy all my life. Just add some weight to them. So my ex helped a lot. Pinterest at first a lot. And then I got it in my head that I was going to become a power lifter. And so I went down the rabbit hole of that. But at 5'9 and having mobility issues, powerlifting at that time was dumb. So, figured out what worked for me functionally a little bit better, and kind of leading my poly family has been a big change, because they were all very big weightlifters. We were in the gym 6 days a week. Often they would be my ride there. My ex-boyfriend in that group taught me more than anyone. And so having to kind of go out and get back into the gym with all of these things that, you know, remind me of this loss, but also are so important for my well-being and for my health and for me to be able to keep going mentally and physically. So that was definitely it took a little while to balance with that. And having to move and get a new gym helped, because at least weren't all the memories of all the gym dates and everything. But yeah, it's definitely been an adventure and a really, really good one.
Wow. So what do you actually have at home? Were you able to find things? I know that, like, the whole world was shopping online for, like, everything.
I had some bands and things left over from physical therapy. So I was using those for a little while. And then I think TJ Maxx or Walmart, one of those was able to open up pretty early here in Virginia. And so I got some, like, kettlebells and just some free weights from my parents' house. But I was like, all right, I can make do with this for a little while longer.
So you never did, like, the water jug on a stick or the or, like, the tire wood plank things? Or...
No, but I did just, like, I'm just going to use my wheelchair. So I would lay on my back and for bench, that was what I was doing.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, with my chair. I got lifted anyway.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
What is yours weigh, 15 to 20 pounds?
Yeah, the one that I was using is about 25 all put together.
Yeah, that's
not much, and it's so awkward.
Oh, man, that'd be a great adaptive strongman event, actually. Yeah. Just press your wheelchair.
BYOC.
Yeah.
Well, not to mention your job's pretty physically taxing, right? Now with COVID, you're running around doing everything. What, changing people, bathing people, carrying them? I read that you did CPR on someone from your chair.
I did do that. So when I was at the bedside full-time, was much more physically taxing. And I've been out of the bedside world for about, almost, in December, it'll be 2 years. I still help out on the floor. And that's when I got to do CPR and learned that I can do all these things in my chair. But that was one of the reasons that it took me so long to get to working out on my own, because I was working on the floor as an ER nurse for 12-hour shifts, 3 times a day. Usually yeah. I was working night shifts. And so I never felt like I could really go hard in the gym, because I needed to be able to function at work the next day. But now that I've taken my position, so right now I'm working as an acute care case manager, which is basically like a social worker in the hospital setting. We do a lot of, like, putting people in nursing homes, a lot of getting people medical equipment, discharges, that kind of thing. So that has helped a lot as well, being able to not have to go as hard at work every day.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
So, yeah, I could relate. I used to love working with spinal cord injuries and, like, people after stroke, but there's no way I could lift and hoist. It doesn't matter how strong I am. Like, I can't lift and hoist giant people anymore. It's not working out.
Yeah.
It's not working out. is what it is.
And there's something else, right? Like the part of the reason why you moved over to case manager was because a lot of the spaces weren't accessible. Like, what is it? The rooms, the hallways, didn't even have enough space for your chair. What's up with that? You're in a freaking hospital.
So I left the ER because my hips were giving out more and more, and I had a couple falls, not with a patient, luckily, but on my own, that scared me enough to be like, you know, the next time this has happened could be with, you know, a patient on my arm, and that was just too much. So I transferred to case management, and it was at that time that I started using my chair full time, and I'm in the main hospital setting, and I'm realizing, you know, there's so many places that my chair doesn't fit in a hospital. Like, it doesn't make any sense. There are only a handful of bathrooms that I can use in my hospital, which is just nuts. And a lot of them, it's people who are making things accessible who don't actually use mobility aids. And so making the lip of the bathroom doors like just high enough that it trips people up, or making the doors just too heavy for a wheelchair user to, you know, open. And I mean, like, I lift weights, I'm fairly strong with my upper body. Like, this is a hospital where your patients are sick and elderly, and if I can't lift it and get these doors open, like, I promise granny can't either. And that's why at first I was very hesitant to kind of work toward getting back on the floor as a wheelchair user, because one, I've never seen a nurse in a wheelchair. And so I started looking around on social media, and I found several and kind of started reaching out to them. And I'm like, all right, how do you practice? Because I've been a nurse for almost 5 years by this point with, you know, while ambulatory. So what does this look like as a chair user? And they started giving so much encouragement and telling me different ways that they were able to do things, as far as, you know, push patients and stretchers, or, you know, tips for reaching IV poles that were up too high and things like that. And so when I realized, like, the only thing that's holding me back from going back to this job that I adore is, one, you know, society's expectations of what a nurse looks like, two, how accessible the place is, and three, just my own mindset and myself just saying, you know, I don't think that I can do this from a seated position. I know I can do it standing, but from seated, for some reason, it just put up this mind block of like, I'm not going to be able to do something for a patient, or I'm going to not want to stay in my chair and get up and help and hurt someone or myself. So there was a lot of that kind of issue back and forth. But now that COVID happened, I got pulled to the floor several times. To try and help out and just see how much I could do. And just that little push was all I needed to realize that there's not much holding me back except for my own thought processes and then the fact that there are places that I can't get to in the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah, but not everybody also has the energy to know that, like, number one, I can try and make this work, but number two, there are a lot of things that won't work. And you're going to have to make people uncomfortable, and you're going to have to let people know, like, hey, this is shit. Like, hey, you need to move this. Hey, this is dumb. So,
hey, rebuild your elevator.
Yeah, there's also right. A lot of that. Because, I mean, just knowing, working in the hospital and having family in the hospital, literally every, like, hospital room experience is you, the able-bodied family member, and then the able-bodied nurse just like shimmying and like sidestepping and like, oh, let me move this. Oh, I'm gonna move the tray. Oh, let me move this IV. Oh, let me move this. Oh, I can't reach it. Oh, excuse me. Can you move? Like,
yeah.
So I can see how you got that mental block of like, me, chair? No way.
Yeah.
Well, and these are 12-hour days at a time. Like you said, you have to be on not only mentally, but physically. Like, you can only imagine all of our nurses in the world are freaking exhausted.
Yeah, that's big.
Now for you to freaking adapt with all of these inaccessible spaces, that's not fair to you. Sometimes you got to take a week not being on the floor. We get that.
Yeah, that was another reason that I was just kind of like, I'm not sure if this is even worth how much effort I knew it was going to get not only myself back on the floor, but to, you know, take down all those precedents that this can't be done or that it shouldn't be done. But another thing that, you know, COVID has done for the disabled population is show us that, oh, hey, there are a lot of things that our jobs can do to make these things more accessible, like allow most of the population to work from home.
Yep.
Or, you know, change things as far as for how long you're going to be working or what your times are. And so seeing that those changes happened also kind of shoved me in the right direction to kind of start fighting back against this. And my joke is always that it was like, as soon as I was put in the chair, suddenly people didn't see me as a nurse anymore. As if all of my nursing education and practice and intelligence and all of that was connected to the function of my legs. It's just been insane to me to see the stark differences in the exact same hospital that I worked before and how people treat me. And, you know, I understand if I'm like, hey, you know, I can help you, like, to a CNA or something. Like, I can help you pull that patient up in bed. And they're like, are you sure? That doesn't bother me. It's more the off chance that I'll get a resident or a physician or something that will argue with me about my nursing knowledge, because how could I possibly have RN after my name if I'm in a wheelchair?
Mm-mm.
People don't like things that are new.
Yeah, it really sucks because you have to bear the brunt of it. You have to be the spokesperson for all nurses in wheelchairs, because that's all there is. Do you at least have somebody, whether it's coworkers or actual admin, that has your back, or are you all alone?
As far as in my job, I luckily working in the ER, so they have my back because they've seen what I can do standing, and they're like, oh yeah, she's fine. Because they saw that there were adaptations that I had to make even back then, because EDS does affect all my joints. You know, I have both of my shoulders I've had surgery on to tighten up the joint. So I had to help kind of pull people up differently because of that. So the docs saw that, totally will vouch for me. The problem is leaders or other nurses in the hospital that don't realize it or have never worked with me before. And so they're the ones that they don't see, that's Ryan, she's a nurse. They just see, oh, that's Ryan, she's in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
So that part.
Who happens to be wearing scrubs?
Yeah.
Fuckers.
Yeah. Handed her a degree.
Seriously. All the
time. She put the wheels on the chair and they were like, here's a degree. Showed up. I don't know how she got here. Who let her in?
Right.
Yeah, I think a lot of us in the disability world are realizing that we're either going to have to be the first of our kind to do something in an industry, or the first in these circles that they've ever seen do and succeed. You know, like for a long time, I had wanted to become a pilot. And I had been researching the fact that we have to research schooling and all of these things, but also, Are we allowed to become a part of law enforcement, go into the military, do all these physical things that they don't see us as fit enough? And I've actually read, you know, there are some partially blind or fully blind people who have flown planes before, or have been missing limbs who have flown planes, but they can't do it commercially. So, you know, that's when you have that roadblock, right? When you're starting to deal with patients and customers who look at you and will never, like, they will refuse service from you, even though you would potentially save their life.
And that's a lot of the pushback that I would get when I would apply for jobs on the floor. It's, well, what if a patient refused to have you care for them? But, okay, well, I also live in the South. I worked in a very small, very rural hospital. And even back then, I would constantly have patients who would refuse to have a black nurse.
That would constantly refuse what? I'm sorry, I didn't catch.
To have a black nurse.
Yeah, so what's the difference?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that's the example I always bring up to them. I'm like, you know, you're going to have patients that refuse to have you as their nurse for any number of reasons. My wheelchair, I promise, will not be the last of them. They would probably hate me more just because I'm tattooed.
Yeah,
you'll
find something.
Right.
You'll find something.
Right. Even if you're the only nurse in the town in the span of 100 miles, you are the only nurse that could possibly again, support them, save their lives, and they will still refuse.
Yep.
Freaking absolutely ridiculous.
And the other thing is, you know, I would go and I would apply for a job. And for example, I had one, my very first time I was ever put down for a job or not given a job because of my disability. I just started walking with a cane and I did a phone interview. And it wasn't even a hands-on nursing position. It was an administrative position. I did the interview. The whole thing was great until I happened to say, you know, hey, also, I walk with a cane, just a heads up. Me being dumb and naive because my disability had been invisible for 20 years. And suddenly all of the praise and all the good things and all the talk about rescheduling that had been happening 30 seconds prior stopped. And suddenly lost my number. I kept calling. They didn't have any record of the interview. They wouldn't let me interview again.
What?
So there what the was fuck?
Nothing I could do. And so that was the first time I ever got hit with that. Back then, I had that kind of choice. Do I disclose my disability or do I not? Now that I don't have that choice anymore, I'll roll into an interview. And the first thing the nurse hiring me is going to see is the chair. And they're going to say, you know, can you do this job? And now that I can honestly say yes, and I have done it, it's still not enough because all they see is the chair. You know, legally, you're not allowed to ask someone, can you do X, Y, and Z? You know, they have to assume that yes, if they apply, that they can. But instead of just giving me a chance, like a shadow shift or something like that, I just get, oh, yeah, we'll call you. We'll call you. It's fine. It's fine. Get me in the door and I will prove to you that I can do way more and will work harder than your able-bodied nurses because I have to stay here.
That just makes me like extra upset because all I'm thinking of is just like all of the years of shitty nurses that I've worked with in hospitals. Like, yeah, somebody that's actually passionate and here for a reason. You're just like, I mean, I don't think she can do it, so maybe not. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, you got somebody that's like pretending to be on the computer and busy all day, but that person can do a better job than you. Okay.
All right, sure.
Sure thing.
No matter how good of a track record, how great and, you know, of a resume you have to constantly prove yourself.
Yeah.
It's BS.
Constantly. And it doesn't matter that, you know, if you mess up that one time, but because you already have all these strikes against you, you're disabled, you know, and I'm heavily tattooed. Oh, I have a half shave. I have all of these things that you just see me and don't know about my work that are going to set me back. So they see that one mess up and they're like, oh, because of her disability, she's out. It wouldn't matter if it was a med mistake or if I dropped a patient. Either way, it's going to be because of my disability.
Mm-hmm. Many doctors have killed people intentionally or unintentionally, and they're still just employed.
Just fine. They're good to go. So as far as your case management situation, is that still 12-hour shifts?
The hours are 8 to 4:30. Monday through Friday, which I was like, this is going to be great. Turns out, you know, I missed my 312s because then you have your 312s, you knock them out, and then you have all that time for your body to recover. Trying to make my little crippled, disabled body work 8 to 5 Monday through Friday has proven ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't function before 10 a.m.
And you got to be up and ready for 5 days straight. Jesus.
Yeah. And so it doesn't matter. You got a bad day or a bad body day or a flare. Like, I can't, you know, just get someone to cover for me or swap my shift for another one later in the week like I could when I was on the floor. But I still get to see patients and I'm still involved in their care. So I'm thankful for that.
I mean, case management is still pretty important. I think a lot of people don't really give it the, like, understand the value in it, because that's the difference between, you know, somebody getting shit on when they leave the hospital or not. Like, that's your job. Although not what you pictured, still very important in a part of the process. How does it work when you have to manage your own care, though, if you're full-time every day forever?
It doesn't. Yeah, I've had a lot of issues with that because I'm basically managing it myself down here, and not a lot of physicians know about EDS, not a lot of them want to even figure out how to manage me. So I've been managing my own care for the last 2 years, and it's honestly been better than it was before. But it is a lot harder working that Monday through Friday, that trying to fit in doctor's appointments and fit in, you know, self-care days and try to live an actual normal life and do normal adult life things. But then, hey, I have this disability that I have to take care of on top of my full-time job and running a platform and Miss Wheelchair Virginia. And
wait, let's talk about Miss Wheelchair Virginia. That's this year, huh?
It's supposed to be 2020, but because of COVID, I'm keeping my title all through 2021. Like, stuck with me now. This is what you get.
Is this a beauty pageant-esque bodybuilding, or like what are you the Miss Wheelchair Virginia of?
So it's an advocacy-based pageant. I'd never heard of it. I didn't know anything about it when I first went out for it. There was a photographer that I'd worked with a few times is the photographer for this program, and he does a lot of like the Miss Virginia and all the beauty photos. So he called me and he's like, hey, you should go out for this. I'd only been in a chair for like 9 months. And so I was like, I don't feel quote unquote disabled enough to be representing, you know, wheelchair users of my home state. Like, no, just go out for it. It'll be a good experience. So I'm not shy. So I was like, all right, I like running my mouth. This could be fun. And I, as long as there's no like bathing suit section or like evening gown.
No talent portion.
Yeah, no talent portion. Like, do you see me? We had to do interview section, very similar to like the Miss America pageant, where you go into a room with some judges and they ask you questions about disability culture, law, and then some just about yourself. Yeah, and so you had to like know your shit. Which was intense for me because I'm like, I did not at the time know all that much about disability culture except for what I had to learn in nursing school. But then we had to also write a speech and kind of develop a platform that we would use, you know, to go around and speak to schools, hospitals, fundraising groups, all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's been ribbon cutting and there's been holding babies and the whole nine. And there's also been a lot more like public speaking, a lot more like telling my story, which has been really, really cool. Especially because I do come from a healthcare background. I've gotten to go to like a statewide physical therapy meeting and kind of educate therapists about this is what Ehlers-Danlos looks like. This is what a new wheelchair user thinks. So I can speak from all of these kind of backgrounds. And especially, I love talking to medical students because they know the least about how to like function around disability and how to speak to someone with a disability if they come in and they're your patient, or how to deal with their mobility aids in a way that's, you know, not going to horrify them. So it's been a really cool journey for sure. I expected to be met with a lot of very catty women and complain a lot about having to wear a crown on my head, but it's been very fun.
That's cool. Funny. You'd think though that medical students would have the most knowledge and comfort with people with disabilities, right? But that's definitely good exposure, especially since people have never seen someone like you in the medical field, and there you are kind of given and forced to create that platform for yourself.
Yeah, it's been cool to kind of develop as I was going along, because I only developed my Instagram platform as a place for me to basically bitch about my own disability, because it was so invisible for most of my life that people who'd known me since birth, you know, had no idea that I was disabled. And so as it was starting to affect more aspects of my life, I decided to go out there and be like, look, I'm going to lay it all on the table. So I had only had chronic DRI and been using it as like a Instagram diary for myself for, you know, less than 2 years when I got this title. And so it became this cool offshoot of a place for me to just kind of spell out what I was going through with my disability. When I was diagnosed at 16, I had no one to compare myself to. Doctors couldn't tell me what a future looked like. They couldn't tell me if I'd be able to walk or not walk. They could tell me nothing. And so back then, social media wasn't a big thing. So I was like, all right, well, let me develop like a place where, you know, if it's just me venting to the void, cool, I'm going to benefit from it. But as I started to pick up steam and started to find all of these, a lot of them younger women who start to look up to someone who was finally laying out, you know, this is what Ehlers-Danlos syndrome has done to me as a human being. Here's what my life looks like. Here are what I've needed to use to get around, to function, to live a full and fulfilling life. And then also showing that, yes, I am disabled. Yes, I use mobility aids. Yes, I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, but I also have a brain, a career, a hobby, friends, a family.
Yeah, it's a whole human here.
Yeah, it's not just
shocker.
Exactly. It's more of it. And so that's another thing. I talk about that more than anything else, that, hey, that patient in your bed is more than just a name on your roster, a name on your sheet. If that is a human that has to go home after you are done with them and live a full life, like, you cannot just think of them as, okay, they're sick and I have to make them better, and here is how I do that. There is more to this, and you have to see that person as a full and complete human being and not just a diagnosis.
Boom.
In my platform.
Boom, bam. Yeah.
Oh man. I'm glad that there are people actually thinking about it and having discussions about it, because that's like, it's 2020, but people still aren't learning these things.
No.
You know, I graduated in 2014 and I didn't really learn about obviously I know that EDS exists, and, you know, like Marfan syndrome, and like there's weird funky wonky things, and then that was like it. Nobody was ever like, oh, you know, this is like totally young people and maybe they'll look fine, and then maybe they'll have to use wheelchairs, maybe they won't, who knows. Like, nah, it was just like, all right, here's a list of things, and next chapter.
And that's the same way nursing school was too. Like, I knew the basics about what it meant to be a wheelchair user and the toll that that could take on a person's body, but you know, you knew, okay, wheelchair users look for pressure sores, had bony prominences, okay, they're going to have issues if they're paralyzed with their blood pressure. Just very basic little things. Not like, how did they live their life outside the hospital as a person? How did they get in this chair? Was it from, you know, paralysis from an accident versus like TM or versus cerebral palsy? Things like that, like where you learn these diagnoses and you learn these like bullet point little informations about each one, about all these different disabilities, about limb loss, all this stuff. But as a practitioner, unless you live in a place or work in a specific field where you're going to see a certain disability over and over and over, you just know that as a box in your med school textbook, and that's it. And that's, you know, not your fault at all. There's a million diagnoses to cover in the world. And like, that's what I tell these medical students, like, don't take this as me saying like you're doing this wrong, but you are. I'm not chastising you. It's, you know, I'm here as another resource for these medical students, for these healthcare practitioners, to say, hey, how do I address sexuality and disability? Or how do I ask my patient what is something that they need at home to function? You know, you can give a patient a wheelchair. Well, that's not the only thing they're going to need to exist. You have to talk about how they live. A lot of smaller hospitals don't have social workers or case managers take on that role. So your nurses and your doctors are the ones who are having to take that on. And I honestly didn't realize how much we were lacking as a practitioner until I was in my wheelchair. I go and I do my patient interviews every morning, and I roll into these patients' rooms where they have been talked down to. They're lying in bed. People stand over them and talk at them all day, every day. And then finally someone rolls in and just happens to be at eye level. And there's this huge change in them as a person. And it's hilarious, just this little thing of just me sitting down. And they look at me and know, okay, this person's disabled. They must know what it's like to be in my shoes. So I'm going to talk real to her.
Just like personal trainers, right? Personal trainers that supposedly look in shape and don't look like me, a person who's disabled or fat or whatever. You cannot relate to me. So you cannot tell me to do 200 push-ups. You know, you do not know what I am capable of because you live a different life. Even those practitioners or physicians who don't have the resources, I feel like your platform, your speeches, all of these talks are so important because it's really a mindset. It's not so much the resources or what you were able to read in med school, like the mindset and the conversations that were lacking surrounding disabilities, surrounding chronic illnesses. And like you said, taking that diagnosis or that disability away from somebody and looking at them as a freaking human that has a life outside of their wheelchair, outside of the hospital bed.
Absolutely. Just because your diagnosis is the same as the last patient that you treated, those two patients are not the same.
Like, they're not going to have the same experiences. And they're not going to need the same thing.
Exactly.
And it's interesting to see what's going to happen to what they call the COVID long haulers, because they're going through what has happened with people with EDS or people with like Lyme disease. Like, even when I went to school, I graduated in 2014, they taught us that Lyme disease was like one and done. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we'll take bites till you got sick and up, then you get better. And then I've met people that are like, yeah, I had Lyme disease like 5 years ago. I'm like, but you sure? Like, that's it? That's not what you sure?
It wasn't in the books.
That's not what they taught me. So it's going to be interesting to see how this turns around with how many thousands of COVID long haulers are we going to have that's really going to shift people to start waking up to, like, okay, maybe we have to actually pay attention to people now.
Yeah. But
it's not the first disease that we've had that's going to have these long-term, you know, fallout that, you know, what is it going to cause? What are these patients going to look like 10, 20 years down the road? It's going to be very interesting to see.
That it is. And is your exercise and the movement a part of these talks when you go speak to people?
Yes.
Do they expect that you're like weak in nothingness or what? Yes. How does that go?
They do. They always ask me about my hobbies, and I'm like, oh yeah, I lift weights. Like, what? When you're diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, that is like the first thing they say, do not do.
Yes, it is.
Do not lose weight. So they never expect that. And so that's why the fitness aspect is a huge part of my talk, because there's a proper way to do everything. And like you were saying, having that personal trainer or that coach that doesn't look like you and doesn't know about your disability was a huge reason that I didn't start working out or didn't start going to the gym, because I knew my body and I knew how easily it was to injure myself. And so I would have these friends that like to lift weights, or I'd try with a personal trainer and they'd be like, no, you just need to do this. You just, and I'm like, no, I know my body and I know that's going to cause me
to gotta push. You just gotta push through it.
Push through it. Like, that's not how this works. And I would get so frustrated because, you know, they didn't know, and there is no training manual for this. And so when I was first starting out, it was lightweight, high rep, just seeing what my body was capable of, because I, for all these years, thought that this was just something I was not going to be able to do. And so that is something I talk about a lot, because a lot of people with Ehlers-Danlos and then with any kind of dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system, which comes with Ehlers-Danlos, so it affects our fight flight resources, reactions, it affects our blood pressure. It's another thing that they are like, no, you're exercise intolerant is something that you can't do. I'm like, no, you just have to find what works for you. Every Ehlers-Danlos patient is completely different, because there's not a lot of research right now to narrow it down. Some people can't deal with lifting weights, but cardio is great for them. I personally, my body does not tolerate strict cardio very well, so I have to, you know, go easy that way. But so there's been a lot of educating my physical therapist that I speak to. You need to teach them, you know, not to fear exercise and not to fear the gym. A lot of symptom management comes from exercise for people with joint disorders and for people with Ehlers-Danlos.
Yeah, that's awesome, because it's such a shame. It should be like a no-brainer. Like, your joints suck. What surrounds your joint? Muscles. Maybe your muscles shouldn't suck. Hello. Like, it should be a no-brainer. But it's not. That's the first thing they tell you is, oh, just drink some water and try swimming or something, you know, take walk.
Yep. I always make sure to also tell them, you know, I have done stupid things. I remember I was doing Arnold presses like 2 years ago with way too much weight that I should have never done. And I ended up having a full shoulder dislocation in the middle of the gym where I couldn't get it back in. And I ended up with me having to get a second shoulder surgery. But this is because I wasn't listening to my body. I wasn't wearing my braces like I was supposed to. Like, these are things that I had no issue being able to do if I was braced properly. Do I look stupid every time I go to the gym? Yes. Do I care? No. Like, this is what makes me happy, and this is what allows me to have the quality of life that I have worked so hard to get back. And if I can convince some other brainwashed little girl that has been told by every doctor she's ever seen that she should never enter a gym and that fitness is terrible for her, that that is not true, then I'm happy that I have made strides with this.
And those accidents literally happen to everybody or anybody. Yeah. Able-bodied folks, like people who don't look like us. Yeah, but the fact that you
put a 10 instead of a 5.
Yeah. Misload the weight, don't put on the right collars, you know. But you have to live in fear because you live with a disability. That needs to change.
And it's funny because people will make blanket statements like, oh, try swimming. Like, swimming is hard.
Uh-huh.
What the hell are you talking about? Like, oh, try yoga. Yoga is also hard. What are you talking about? Like, you're not helping anyone.
The easier things like swimming and yoga. No.
I've seen research articles like, oh, low impact activities like jogging. Like, that's not low impact. Who are you?
You could still injure yourself doing all of those things.
Yeah, it's been a treat. That, and then once I started to get more into the gym and then, you know, branching out of what I was comfortable in and looking at people doing Pilates and people using different gym equipment that have disabilities and finding them on the internet and seeing people with Ehlers-Danlos doing these lifts with these horribly hypermobile extensions of their joints. And I'm just like, okay. So then I started getting into making videos of, okay, if you have an Ehlers-Danlos body, this is what this move is going to look like. This is what it's going to feel like. And here's how we could do it safely. You don't like wearing braces? Here's the way to do it that way. If you like wearing braces, here's some recommendations. Just because you don't get that. And so social media has at least given us that, you know, conversation again. So that's nice.
And we honestly just need more physicians and nurses that are weightlifters because they know the body. They understand movement.
Yeah, we got honestly, these crusty old ass like neurologists and like old ass rheumatologists. Like, these guys haven't seen a treadmill or like put on a pair of shorts in decades trying to tell us how to move. Like, what? Like, it really does piss me off. And not that every therapist is going to be amazing, but if you're coming to see a doctor and you're like, I have pain, I have a problem, it should be like, boom, go see a physical therapist, figure your shit out. Even that doesn't happen. It makes no sense to me.
No, because they got to make money off of pharmaceuticals. Don't forget about that. We got to do all the x-rays, all the tests.
I came in after the oral press incident and the dislocation, and I was like, I did this lifting weight. And they were just like, well, you need to stop that immediately. And if you're having issues with pain control, we have pills that you can use instead of working out. I'm like,
There's a lot about your story that's very interesting, and I'm sure a lot of people would love to hear more. But generically speaking, what would you say to someone with the hypermobile body? Just like two sentences, where should they start if they want to start moving or working where they think they can't work?
As far as starting out with fitness of any kind, you know, start with what feels good. What did you love to do before your body kind of got to where it is now? That, and if the gym is intimidating at first, you know, building up that baseline strength is important. So body weight, everything. There's so many exercises that you can do just using your body weight that, you know, if done correctly, use YouTube, you find yourself a, you know, Instagram fitness influencer that you like and trust and go from there. Start small, but, you know, move your body, move your joints. Yes, it is going to hurt at first. Yes, it is going to be awkward at first, but it will be worth it. Give it time and don't just go one time and quit.
Yeah.
And where can people find you if they want to check out how you move and how you live and how you Miss Wheelchair Virginia 2020 to 21?
To 21.
You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram, all the same handle. It's going to be chronically_ry. You can find my modeling, gym stuff, and all of my travels as Miss Wheelchair Virginia.
You're welcome anytime. This is your house too now. You don't have to ask before you go in the fridge. Just let us know when you come over. And
good.
That's that. Disabled girls out.
Thank you.
Yay!
Thanks for listening to Disabled Girls Who Left. We appreciate all of your support and everyone who's taken the time to show us some love. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, or write a review of our channel. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Player FM, Google Podcasts, and more. You can also find us on Instagram @DisabledGirlsWhoLift.